We're going to start today with a conversation with Greg Gianforte, an entrepreneur whom I've admired greatly for a long time. I've known him for a long time. Greg was the founder and CEO of Right Now Technologies, and Right Now went public and then eventually was acquired in 2011 for $1.5 billion. Greg, welcome. It's been a little bit of time for us to get you on here, but I'm super glad that we could make it happen.
Yeah, Sarmana, it's my pleasure.
So, Greg, I know you're a very big believer in the same methodology and the same philosophy that we follow here in 1 million by 1 million. So you started Right Now in 1997 in Montana after selling your first bootstrap startup to McAfee for $10 million. We believe in this, you know, off-center, non-obsession with Silicon Valley. We believe that entrepreneurship should be happening everywhere. You chose Montana. Why Montana, and what was it like to start a tech company in Montana?
Yeah, so thank you again, Sarmana. Thanks for having me on. Montana's where my wife, Susan, and I wanted to raise our kids. We have four children, and this is a place I've been coming for a long time. It was really, the fact is the quality of life here is amazing. And we knew that, I had this theory that back in the late 90s, that mid-90s, that the internet was starting to change the rules of business and really removed geography as a constraint in where you locate a business. So that was a theory. We loaded up our Ford Bronco and drove our little kids in diapers all the way to Montana. And we got here and people said, well, you can't do that here. That's not possible. You don't have air travel. There's no money. You don't have the right people. No one else has ever done it before. So that was part of it too. I like big challenges. And with a lot of people telling us it was impossible, that was actually encouragement to me.
So you bootstrapped Right Now from $0 to $6 million with no outside capital. And part of the story was that no one was going to fund the Montana startup, if I remember. How did you do it? It's a fascinating story. It's an encouraging, inspiring story. Tell us how you did it.
Well, it's really just, it's common sense and elbow grease, really. You just, it's a lot of hard work. The first thing I did, and actually there's a good resource for people. Inc. Magazine did a story on the first startup. It's still available on the internet. It's called Start With Nothing. It has a picture of me sitting in an office chair in the middle of a cut wheat field with the mountains in the background and a pad of paper and nothing else. And that's really where we started. My wife and I started the business together. We did it in our home. With no outside capital. And the first thing I did was, I always believe the largest opportunities are created when there's some discontinuity in the business fabric. And in the late 90s, the biggest discontinuity we had was the maturation of the internet and the impact that it had on business functions that corporations had. So I was a software guy. Right Now was actually my fifth startup that I had done. And I combined really internet with software, and then I picked a business function that was being disrupted by the internet. And, you know, I just picked customer service or customer experience. And so the first month when I decided to start, I didn't write any software, although I'm a techie by training. I made 400 phone calls, and I called people that were running customer service operations for technology companies, because they tend to be the early adopters. And at first I was just calling customer service people saying, so how is the internet impacting your business? And I think that there's a lot of wisdom in, Confucius said, you're never in a position to learn until you're totally confused. So I immersed myself in with these potential clients, understanding what problems they had. And it was very clear early on that the problem was they had these call centers, they were budgeted, but they weren't getting budget to answer emails. And all the other vendors in the marketplace were providing solutions that made customer service agents able to answer emails faster. And no one goes to a website of a corporation hoping to send the company an email. They want to go to the website to find an answer. So we had a very simple idea that if we could put the answers up on the website, that would be better for customers, and it would reduce costs for the companies. So after 400 phone calls, I got to the point where I had a 4 or 5 bullets on a sheet of paper that described this product that we were thinking about. And it wasn't even really a product. It wasn't even really a feature. It was just a featurette. And that, at the end of 400 phone calls, people were starting to say, if you had that, I would pay you money for it. And then being an engineer, I locked myself in a room for 6 weeks, and I built that featurette. So I had 40 paying customers before I hired the second employee, besides my wife and myself. And so that's how we got started.
So now, I remember that it took you 2 years to get to 6 million. Our mantra in 1M1M, and a lot of this, you know, I talked to you way before I started 1 million by 1 million, and several other people who believe in this bootstrap first, raise money later mantra, and that has become the 1M1M mantra. And you were definitely one of the key inspirations for this this mantra. And you obviously, you followed that mantra and had an incredible Series A financing round in 1999. What was your Series A valuation? And please talk to our audience about the pros and cons of following this strategy. They should hear it from somebody other than me.
Yeah, so first I'll advocate for bootstrapping, which is what I call it. And I have a book that I've written. I've had the pleasure of lecturing now at Harvard and Stanford and Berkeley and London School of Business to all the MBA students on this concept of starting a company with customers' money, not with venture capital funding or professional money. And it's kind of interesting when I do these lectures, the students love the presentation, but I've actually never been invited back to any of these places. So it's because it's so contrary to what these business schools teach. They teach that if you want to start a business, you write a business plan, you go raise money, and then what they don't say is you start a bonfire and you pitch the money on the bonfire and you hope there's a company there before you run out of money. And it's probably the highest risk way to start a company. So the benefits of bootstrapping are really is if you don't have any money, you can't make a fatal mistake. The number one job is to understand who your client is, how you're going to create value for them. It really forces you to you know, put the rubber on the road and understand, do you have a value proposition to work? I mean, it involves just going to potential clients and saying, will you give me money for this particular piece of value? So the other advantage is not only can't you make a fatal mistake because you don't have the money to do that, you end up owning most of the business. So even after we went public in 2004, the employees at Right Now Technologies still own 70% of the business. And we gave 20% of the equity to the employees, even after 8 years of being public. We were publicly traded from 2004 to 2012. Just the residual stock options, just the ones the employees had not sold, caused our local county payroll to jump 14% in a single year. It was about $80 million that went to employees just from the residual stock options just in Gallatin County, Montana, and in a state where we're 49th in the country in wages and a lot of the young people have to leave, this has created a whole second wave of economic opportunity, so much so that 40% of all the wage growth in the whole state occurred in Bozeman last year. And so that's the thing that is great about bootstrapping is that you end up owning the business. It allows you to create opportunities for others. And I think it's a much lower risk way of starting a business than using the bonfire approach.
And if I remember correctly, in 1999, when you raised your Series A financing with $6 million in revenue, you had $130 million valuation. Of course, that was also the peak of the market. The dot-com bubble was in full swing, so the market was very hot.
I think it was 120, but still, it was a high valuation, you know, we raised $32 million and sold just over 20% of the business, so we still very much stayed in control. In hindsight, I'm not sure it helped us grow any faster. We did get a new set of people on our board that were helpful to us, although at times they were distracting. So I think that I just think that, you know, every pit of money you get, whether it comes from a customer or comes from a VC, comes with strings. And I firmly believe that money you get from customers is the only one that comes with strings that actually pull you forward. The money from other sources tends to be distracting. I mean, to compare a VC scenario with our startup process, I spent 1 month making phone calls, 6 weeks building a product, and then I had revenue. Compare that with six months writing a business plan, 6 months of marketing it, hope maybe you get money at the end of that period. You still don't know if you have a viable product or not. So the bootstrap process allows you to fail a lot faster. So in the time it takes you to write a business plan and raise money, you probably could have tried three or four different ideas, and then you'll end up owning the whole thing and you'll be better off in the end.
And it takes 6 to 9 months to go beat on the doors of investors and raise money, which is time you could be actually beating on the doors of customers and have a much more productive time. So, Greg, you talked a lot about...
One thing I want to add. I have a little sign on my desk that says, which is the heart of bootstrapping. It says, nothing happens till somebody sells something.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So you talked about Montana. Tell us, how did you manage to grow in Montana? This company became quite significant, and as you rolled out some numbers on how much economic value it produced for the region, talk to us about how did you manage the growth in Montana?
We just held on. I mean, we doubled revenue and employees every 90 days for years. It was just a rocket ship, and we did that without outside capital. So we just focused on cash flow. The key thing in any business, I'm a big fan of Jim Collins, Good to Great. We used his kind of servant leadership approach and in leadership development. We found being in a rural location, hiring was a little harder, but retention was easier. Our quality of life is huge. We also didn't suffer, and I apologize in advance for this, some of the Bay Area myopia that occurs, because there's groupthink that goes on, and being outside of Silicon Valley allowed us to be, I think, more creative and living in the natural beauty that we have here. Bozeman is a community university town of about 40,000. We have 5 mountain ranges all the way around, blue ribbon trout streams, rock climbing, skiing, whitewater rafting, all within a 20-minute drive. And no one has a big commute. The most is 10 or 15 minutes. So that means employees tend to spend more time at work, and they also get more time at home. So families are happier. There's also one of the things I like about a small community is there's something I did not expect when I moved here. I call it it's small town accountability. In a big city, let's say you're working in San Francisco, the people you're at work with are different than the people that you see at home at soccer practice with your kids or these sorts of things. So there's a certain anonymity that occurs. You can separate those two lives. In a small town, you can't do that. So if you're an idiot at work in a small town, you're still an idiot when you get home. So that's a very positive impact on corporate culture, which was also a benefit. So we focused on leadership, and we couldn't necessarily hire all the time. I would put our management team up against anybody's, but we had to spend more energy growing our own talent, and I think that allowed us to inculcate the culture we wanted. And combining that with the Montana work ethic, which is unsurpassed, was really a competitive advantage for us.
So how much were you able to hire within Montana from the Montana region, and how much did you have to hire outside and move people to Montana?
All of the above. But I will say our experience was the most fertile field for hiring was either Montanans or people who had grown up here but moved away because they had family ties here. So we did a lot of things. We had a website that was entitled www.iloveithere.com, and we bought billboards on the highway between the airport and the ski area, and it basically said, live the dream. you can work here and have a fabulous career.
And how many at your peak? How many people worked at Thread now in Montana?
So we had 1,100 people total globally in 17 offices. About half were in Montana. So we were the largest commercial employer in Bozeman. And now that business was sold to Oracle. They're now the largest commercial employer. In fact, we just broke ground on another building for them. So they continue to expand here. So it was a great outcome.
And what have you done, your success and the leadership role that you have played, what has that done to the Montana entrepreneurship ecosystem? Have you developed much of an ecosystem there now?
Well, it's been really a joy to see. I think now there's been between one and two dozen companies that have spun out of right now that are like this next generation of technology companies. In fact, about 18 months ago, we started a nonprofit high-tech business alliance, which is essentially a trade organization. And we really didn't know how many tech firms were here because they're nearly invisible. They exist in business parks. They generally don't have customers in the state. They're here for the quality of life and the quality of the employees. Well, I'm happy to report that we have 255 member companies now in Montana. This sector, we did an economic impact study on it earlier this year, and we found it's already 10 to 15% of the state economy, growing 8 to 10 times faster than the state economy, and creating jobs that are double the state median. So Other people are realizing this is a huge opportunity. That website is mthightech.org. Many of these companies are hiring. There's a jobs portal there. If people want to come to Montana and further their tech career, we'd encourage them to sign up.
Awesome. So, you know, we just started working with Delaware and the Delaware Economic Development Office, and they found us. You know, they found 1 million by 1 million, and the person who runs that small business program was following these roundtables for a year, and then he kind of sold the partnership internally, and now we are essentially the program that we have set up with them is the Delaware government has bought a whole bunch of 1 million by 1 million premium membership, and they are giving those out to a whole bunch of Delaware companies to incubate with us, and as a result they will be following the same mantra of bootstrap startups and not be running after financing. I've given a bunch of press statements because immediately, as soon as this partnership was announced, the media, the local media in Delaware were reporting, oh, this is going to help raise Silicon Valley financing. I'm like, no, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to help them build businesses. We're going to teach them how to, sell, how to market, how to get to customers. And we're very, very interested in facilitating this kind of economic development. The other place where I've seen a very interesting, kind of movement of tech startups happening is in Utah. I don't know if you're following what's happening in Utah. There have been, the big acquisition, the first company that, like you, you were the anchor company, anchor success story in Montana, Omniture was a big success story in Utah. And Adobe bought Omniture. Now there's a whole bunch of really, really good companies, starting up and getting to some scale in Utah. So are you in touch with other economic development organizations that are trying to do what you've done in Montana?
We have had some inquiries. My focus has really been Montana, although I know Josh James well at Omniture, and I sit on one board down in Salt Lake, and it's amazing what's going on there, and you're absolutely right. Once you have an anchor client that has demonstrated what people need are role models, that this can happen, and we're seeing that now in Montana. So our goal has been to make Montana high tech not be a contradiction in terms, because people think of Montana, they think of cowboys and open range and mountains and quality of life. They don't necessarily think of high wage jobs. So we're trying to connect the dots on that.
And are you going to, I've read a little bit of speculation, are you going to seek political office?
Well, I about 6 weeks ago, I filed an exploratory committee for the governor of the state of Montana. So at this point, I'm out talking to Montanans about what they want. And the reality is, as I mentioned earlier, Montana is 49th in the country in wages. And the tragic consequence of that is many of our young people who are bright and very capable have to leave the state to find a job that pays a decent wage. And so that's the problem. If that's something that Montanans want me to go to work on, that's the question I'm exploring at this point.
And if you were to if you were to win that position, what is the strategy that you would follow to scale what you have been able to achieve, at a limited scale? But how are you going to scale that?
Well, I'm a big believer in the free market, and that opportunity and prosperity is really only created. There's not the primary role for government is stay out of the way. But there is a role in education. One of the things we did here in the state, we didn't have enough computer science graduates. So in 2013, we only had 40 computer science graduates in the whole state across 30,000 college students. So we started, me and another gentleman here locally, Rob Irizarry, we started a program called Code Montana, and we bought online digital curriculum from two guys out of Stanford, and we made it available free of charge to every high school and middle school student in the state. And I'm thrilled to report that our computer science enrollment at two of our universities in the state has gone up over 50% in the last 2 years. Because at the end of the day, although tech companies create jobs for all kinds of people, for salespeople, accountants, administrators, if you don't have the techies, that's like the seed to a farmer. You don't get a crop. So we needed more high school students pursuing computer science, and I'm thrilled that we're able to do that. I think the state has a role in encouraging young people to connect the dots between education and economic outcomes. And so techie is one direction, but we also have lots of jobs here in the state in our construction industry, in manufacturing, other areas. Not everybody's going to go get a four-year degree, but learning how to weld or swing a hammer does create a career that allows them to support a family and thrive. So I think education is a big part of what is necessary. And somehow in this country, and particularly in Montana, we have a disconnect between educational pursuits and economic outcomes. I think we need to connect the dots on those.
And if you were to extrapolate that thinking to the federal level, to national level, is it the same logic? Is there anything else that you think the government should be doing?
Well, I think that, at a national level, we continue to fall behind relative to other countries in our education area. You can see, just look at the data, we keep dropping. I have this crazy idea, you probably agree with me, but I think computers are here to stay. I personally would like to see computer science education in every high school. Now, what I think these education decisions, though, are better made at a local level, where the specifics of local municipalities and states can handle that. I'm not sure there's a big federal mandate to stick their fingers in those areas, because the states do a pretty good job, and there's more that could be done, though.
So my take on that is, at the minimum, some amount of programming and some amount of entrepreneurship education should be compulsory, actually, as part of college education.
I think it should be, actually, even at the high school level, I think it should be part of the core math curriculum. And I think that's, it just makes sense. I think, any college student I talk to, even if they say I'm studying anthropology, I tell them, you should do a minor in computer science. In our household, mm-hmm. we have four children. They're age 26 to 19. And we followed the Henry Ford approach to education in our home, where we told our kids they could study anything they want as long as it's engineering. And our kids are doing well. In fact, our daughter just finished her freshman year last spring in computer science at Stanford, and she came home to Bozeman. She got a job with a tech firm, and they paid her what you'd normally pay a college freshman, $10 an hour. That was perfectly fair. But this company here in Bozeman, it's actually a former co-worker at Right Now Technology, started this company. They're now up to 50 employees, high-wage jobs, for college graduates. They trained her for 1 week, and my daughter, Rachel, they started billing her out at $200 an hour. So
they were paying her $10 an hour, billing her at $200 an hour. Wow.
I said, Rachel, you've just had your first course in economics. It was a great experience. There's no regrets, but it just shows you the level of demand.
Yeah, that's awesome. Fabulous. So, Greg, shall we talk to some of our entrepreneurs here today?
Sure.